You are listening to Covenant Eyes Radio. All this week, we are exploring the issue of sex trafficking, hearing the stories of ordinary people who are doing extraordinary things to combat this evil around the world. When Teresa Flores was 15 years old, she was drugged and raped by a boy she knew. Photos were taken of her sexual encounter, and with these, she was blackmailed, ultimately leading to her spending the next 2 years as a sex slave. All of this happened while living in an upper-middle-class suburb of Detroit. Today, Ms. Flores is the Director of Education and Training at Grace Haven House, a care and rehabilitation home for young girls who have been victimized by human trafficking. She has been a social worker for over 20 years and is the author of The Slave Across the Street. Today, Teresa is a voice on behalf of the 250,000 American teens who are trafficked every year. She speaks with us today about her decades of experience working with teens who are at risk for sexual exploitation, at times in the most unlikely of places. She talks about why it's so hard for many well-to-do Americans to believe that sexual exploitation might be happening right under their nose in their own communities. Teresa also talks about simple ways people can use their gifts and talents to fight this injustice in their own areas. Today's interview is being conducted by Marianne Jang, an intern at Pure Hope.
So yesterday we talked to Regan Hill, and so your experience with sex trafficking looks drastically different from hers. Regan actually read your book to learn about the issue when she first stumbled upon resources, and yet at the same time there's some similarity between what you both went through because both of you started doing advocacy work. It was something that kind of came upon you that God said, like, I would like you to move into this area. And you had spent, you know, a significant amount of time working in social work. So I'm wondering if you can talk to us a little bit about your background and what it was like to enter into advocacy work after being in social work for so long.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I knew, like, after I had, you know, escaped from the whole situation that I wanted to go to, I was trying to think of what am I going to go to college for, and I just knew that social work was the right fit. I knew deep down that I wanted to help girls, and I actually, in the beginning, wanted to be a guidance counselor in the high schools because I felt like nobody saw the signs and helped me, and I didn't want others to go through that. But just because of moving around and the programs and stuff, it was really difficult to become a school social worker in the state that I was in because you had to also become a teacher. And so I decided to just become a social worker, and I always kind of focused on adolescents and teens that were pregnant and troubled. So that just seemed like a natural fit. And I did that for over 20 years. And so I think that it was a really easy transition into, you know, being an activist and advocate. I never thought of myself that I would become an activist. I just always, you know, saw different people's causes and thought, oh, that's wonderful. I'll just write a check or, you know, support them, get a bumper sticker. But I just never thought that I would be one. And it was surprising that when something kind of grabs a hold of you and bites you, how much easier it is to become passionate about it.
Your own experiences being trafficked in high school, they didn't lead you to activist work, but they led you to work with people who were at risk. So kind of troubled girls in the adolescent age. Can you speak to that need that you saw for that or what it was like when you decided that you wanted to pursue girls that might fall into the same trap that you did?
Yeah, I mean, it was just, you know, just an easy transition because I wanted to be there for somebody, like I said, because nobody was there for me. So, I knew that this was a huge problem, you know, being at risk and being exploited and being vulnerable, that people really weren't even looking at, especially in the suburban high schools. So a lot of the kids I worked with weren't really inner city kids. They were all kids that came from, you know, middle income, two-parent families. So I think I was more comfortable with that because I understood where they came from. So I even worked in a high school or a school for a short time too, and that was the same, you know, same scenario, kind of middle to upper income, and people just they had a hard time, you know, even if there was some suspected child abuse in a kid. People in those schools and families just had a really hard time understanding that this could be possible. So it really wakened me up to the fact that people just don't want to see this.
Okay. So those are some big challenges. And how do you kind of address that for people who are in denial and have a really hard time believing that it could happen to their kids or anyone in their community?
Well, I get that a lot. And a friend of mine, Kathleen Davis with the Polaris Project, she had said that, you know, she's gotten phone calls before by, you know, very well-to-do churches and stuff, and that they're like, you know, is Teresa Flores for real? Is this really, you know, the true story? She said they just have a really hard time believing, and they don't want to believe that this is a problem. Because then if it is a problem, and if it is this big, then they might have to do something about it. People in that socioeconomic background have more denial that this is a fact, because they don't want to face the fact that, you know, this could be happening to their child's friend or their child even. So it's very difficult because it's kind of like another kick in the pants. Like, you know, I'm telling you that this happened. This is a huge problem, and you still don't believe it. You know, so it's very difficult to face those kind of people when they don't want to believe it.
And so with those attitudes that you see kind of on a constant basis, Was it hard for you as well to kind of transition into speaking about it, to being open about what you went through, and then making it your work? Did you have any major hesitation?
Yeah, I know what you mean. It made it really difficult to talk about it because then I had to face the people that weren't believing me and hear all the comments. After I went on the Today Show, I saw all the comments that were listed on the website, and it was probably 90% disbelieving people, very negative. But then it also made me even that more adamant that this is exactly what needed to be done. It was just kind of like God was showing me, you know, this is people's mentality out there, and this is why I've charged you with this job.
God has called you to speak about this and to speak out for those mm-hmm. who are still victimized. That's really what really keeps you going in all of the engagements that you have. And despite all the
mm-hmm. it definitely keeps me going. And then each, you know, young girl that emails me or calls me, I mean, it does keep me very motivated and determined to do this job that he's given me, because of hearing people's comments and then these, you know, people coming to me saying me too. So it's made the mission a little easier, but it's still a very difficult mission.
What encouragement might you have for people who can't go on speaking tours and aren't necessarily
right.
the kind to open up a shelter, or even, you know, they might say, well, My work is not people oriented. I can't go and help do physical therapy for these kids. What do I offer?
It's kind of examining your gifts. So what are your gifts? What areas you're passionate about? And matching that to the time you have available, your finances, your education, things like that. So I know students in high school that they're great organizers of volunteers, and so they get together volunteers and they do fundraisers. They might do garage sales. People, mm-hmm. Girl Scout groups volunteer to make bracelets that then Grace Haven can sell. So there's lots and lots of stuff people can do, from organizing letter campaign writing programs, you know, where people are writing their senators and representatives, to, you know, just stuffing envelopes for organizations and running different kinds of fundraisers. There's so much that people can do. I know of a guy that used to love to run, and he has five daughters. And he decided he was going to run from New York to Washington in chains. And everybody that stopped him said, you know, what are you doing? And he's like, well, let me tell you. Let me tell you about the people that are enslaved in this country. And so it was something very simple that he could do. It was a big sacrifice, but he affected so many the lives of so many people by that.
You have a couple campaigns that are definitely much more accessible to the non-marathon runners in us.
Mm-hmm.
Can you speak a little bit about Traffic Free and Soap?
Sure. One of the things that I do is I just realize the need to try and rescue the girls, that it's so hard to reach them. But I also knew that they were being taken to motels, to servicemen, and to stay there while they were in town for a specific sporting event or an event in a community that was bringing in particularly a lot of men, such as the Super Bowl or like the NCAA tournaments or the Detroit Auto Show. And so I remembered just from my own experience that the bathroom is pretty much the only place you're allowed to go unaccompanied. And so God put it upon my heart to get bars of soap out to these hotels that the girls would be at with the 1-800 hotline number. And so what I do is I go into a certain community, a town or city that has a huge event coming in, and we get volunteers to just put the labels on the soaps and actually get teams to go out to these motels and talk to them, take an opportunity to spend some time and say, hey, you know, do you know that this big sporting event coming to town is going to bring in lots of girls, and there's lots of missing kids in this area, and we want to try and find them. So it's a really neat way to utilize volunteers, you know, one day out of their time to go and do this, and it's something that a lot of people have a lot of fun with, too.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I'm actually just read an article about the movement in Brazil to start addressing sex trafficking because of the Olympic Games and the World Cup in 2014. And it's this kind of global issue that sometimes we think it's only here or it looks different. And so I don't know specifically, you know, how they're going to mobilize, but it'll be really interesting to follow that because it's a culture that's not going to deny what's going on.
Yeah, and there's such a huge problem with it in that country specifically that it'll be interesting to see what people do to unite and bring awareness to the issue and help rescue the kids.
Do you know specifically ways that trafficking looks similar across different cultural backgrounds, or does it take place differently in the U.S.?
There's both differences and similarities. The psychological coercion that traffickers use on victims, you know, regardless of which country you're in, would also be very similar. So differences might be their socioeconomic background, if they're impoverished, if it's part of their culture where parents sell them and that's accepted. You know, there's a lot of differences in other countries versus here, but all of the underlining psychological aspects are exactly the same.
For girls who are struggling with that psychological trauma, I've heard that the resources for them are very slim. And so can you speak to some of the services that are really lacking right now in the U.S.?
Yeah, sure. Housing would be the number one service that's lacking. A lot of them can't go back home. A lot of them are runaways or been involved in the foster care system. They said over 500,000 kids are involved in the foster care system in the U.S. So a lot of them don't have, you know, good parents to go home to. So housing that is therapeutic and long-term is really essential. They're up to now about 100 beds for youth that have been trafficked in the United States. So I think that's probably about 5 shelters. But the FBI and National Missing Children's will tell you there's 100,000 Americans or kids that are going through it right now. So even 100 beds is not nearly, you know, enough. so there needs to be, you know, we say in Ohio there needs to be probably 7 in every state just to fill the demand. And then maybe some outpatient centers as well where they can come to for counseling and support groups, things like that. So it needs to be a place that they're safe and that they can trust people. And they really need to be faith-based as well to be able to get kind of the holistic healing that they're going to need.
And so Ohio specifically where you work, Grace Haven will be the first home.
Yes, exactly.
I guess I have a different question that'll hopefully be very helpful for people who are listening. What about the community do you wish was kind of different? What can we do in our lifestyle that would decrease the environment for this?
The easy answer is to not refer to human trafficking as teen prostitution or child prostitutes anymore. That would be a first easy step people could take in media. You know, I see so many newspaper reports and TV interviews and stuff where they're talking about, you know, 42-year-old man was arrested for, you know, prostituting a teen. There is no such thing. And as soon as we can stop saying that, I think that will be a first huge step. Because we view it in our society as prostitution as an option and a choice, and society needs to understand that that is not the case, that nobody would choose to do that. So the second would be really making a call out to, again, media, but advertisers and stuff, even, you know, Cosmopolitan Magazine and all these places that are just so sexualizing our society and making it normal. Those two things would be a huge first step.
You have been listening to our interview with Teresa Flores on Covenant Eyes Radio. You can read more of her story at trafficfree.com. That's TRAFFICKFREE.com. Our special host, Marianne Jang, was an intern this summer at Pure Hope for their Pure Justice internship program. Learn more about this internship experience at purehope.net. Look for Covenant Eyes Radio on iTunes or find more podcasts at the Covenant Eyes blog, Breaking Free, at covenanteyes.com/blog.